This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We did last week, the two weeks ago, the creation of Shabbat, the creation of rest. But there's actually another turning point also that occurs at this stage. And to understand it, let's look at verse 4. Eile toldot ha-shamayim v'ha-aretz behibaran. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created. Beyom asot Hashem Elokim eretz v'shamayim. On the day when Hashem Elokim made land and earth and heaven. What are the questions on that set, on that passage?
Was it
What's the first question? Let's ask the first question first. What's the first question? First question first.
Why is there a need for the repetition?
Of what?
Of the
authentic. Okay, that's the first question. And the second question now, we've got to go in order. No. That's the obvious questions first. This one is, we've already been told that the heaven and earth was created. Well, that's part of the same, that's the same as the Cain's question. Why? Where? Because of these are the generations. But that's becoming a bit poetic already. Let's first concentrate, that's a nice point, but let's first concentrate on the simple, straightforward questions. Got one question. The second question is, the sentence itself is repetitious. These are the generations of the heaven and the earth when they were created on the day when God made heaven and earth. And in the sentence itself, there's too much. That's the third question, right? Very good. Now the one is, this is the role of heaven and earth is switched around, or the order of heaven and earth is switched around. The first half of the sentence, it says these are the generations of heaven and earth, shamayim and oretz. In the end of the sentence, it says eretz v'shamayim. Now the fourth question is the most important of all. It's not a question; it's an observation. Yeah, okay, but that's not serious. Now the fourth one is an observation, not even a question. No. Yeah, that will come to, but now a main thing, a very, very important point. No. That's the point there. That's a point. It's a valid point, but not what I'm looking for. Hashem and the king together. We're coming closer. One of the failures of modern education that you concentrate on what you're learning at the moment only, and you forget everything you learned before. When you go to first year university, if you pass your exams, you're entitled to forget everything you learned in first year, because now you've got to pass second year exams. You've already finished first year, you don't have to remember it anymore. When you finish second year, you don't have to remember second year anymore. You just have to get busy with third year. But it doesn't work like that in Torah. When you're on the second chapter, you have to remember the first chapter as well. This is the first time that the name of Hashem, spelt this way, occurs in the whole Torah. And like any first, it's important and highly significant. The first time that the name of Hashem spelt Yud Kei Vav Kei, we're not allowed to pronounce it, we're not even allowed to spell it out. It's the first time that the name of God spelt in this way appears in the whole Torah. That's the most important aspect of the sentence. What was really created on the seventh day?
We took it quite far last time, what was created on the seventh day, but we didn't really go all the way. What was really created on the seventh day?
That's what we said last time, but we want to go further. No, you're getting a bit fastidious, really. We touched on it when we talked about the bracha of Shabbos, the blessing of Shabbos, that before Vayekadesh, or before God sanctified the Shabbos, he blessed the Shabbos, meaning, you'll remember, that he created the world in such a way as to make sure that if you don't work on Shabbos, you can earn sufficient during the week to make up for Shabbos. He created the world in such a way that it can continue to operate on Shabbos. But every other day the world can't continue to operate if you turn it off for one day. But for Shabbos you can turn the world off and it will continue on its 6-day momentum to operate throughout the day of Shabbos. Let's take that concept a little bit further and understand what God's really created. He's created the ability, or he's built in a control to productivity. Up until the 6th day, there was no variation, there was no tolerance on productivity. It was all computerized, it was all predetermined. He built in certain formulas, he created the world in a certain day, on the first day this happened, on the second day this happened, on the third day this happened, and so the world would have gone on, working strictly according to preconceived formula. Shabbos is the first time that there's a break in the formula, that all the formulas of creation stop working. We even pointed out, you'll remember, that it doesn't say Vayehi Erev Vayehi Boker, it doesn't even say it was evening, it was morning, because even the formula for evening and morning stops working. Yes, scientifically there's an evening and morning, but conceptually it's all one period of time, you remember we discussed. There was no conceptual evening and no conceptual morning when it comes to Shabbos. The difference in atmosphere between evening and morning and when it comes to Shabbos is minimized. It's not the same as other days of the week. And the whole structure of living, the whole structure of productivity, the whole structure of society and of science changes on Shabbos. And it stops. In fact, a lot of it stops. What's introduced on Shabbos, or let's put it this way, it's not by chance that Shabbos follows immediately on the creation of man. So this new element that's introduced now, this now the whole Torah changes. At this point there's a change this is the first turning point in Torah. Up till now everything's been relatively predictable, quite exciting, but relatively predictable. Now there's a complete change and unpredictability comes in. It's not by chance this change is set off, not by the creation of Shabbos really, but by that which was created immediately before Shabbos. What was that? The human being. That's what now changes. The world is now a different place because man has come in, and it was necessary to create Shabbos with man. Man without Shabbos doesn't work. Why? What God is really creating on Shabbos is the concept of reciprocity. And we call that in Torah language Hashgacha Pratit. Hashgacha Pratit means personal attention, individual attention. Normally individual attention is taken to mean that God controls our individual lives, that everything that happens to us, every little tiny aspect of our lives is personally directed by the Ribono Shel Olam. In fact, Hashgacha Pratit means something else. It means that we control our lives. More than that, it means we control God's life to a degree. Let's try and understand that. If the world would have continued as it was before the creation of Shabbos, if man would have been created on the sixth day and the next day started Sunday again without a Shabbos, then man could have had no influence over the course of events. Then he's living in a programmed society. Shabbos is necessary to break the program, to show that things can occur beyond the program and outside of the program. It's not built into the program that you can stop everything for a day and yet the world will still continue to function. That wasn't part of the program. Shabbos was the introduction of miraculous living, of living not according to laws of physics and chemistry, of living according to some other kind of law which was only introduced on Shabbos and had to be introduced once man is introduced, because man is a Baal Bechira, man is a person who has the ability to choose.
And in order for that choice to have meaning, there's got to be consequence. That's the last couple of Matzah Shabbos Shiurim that we've been discussing about. The fact that it's necessary for a man to feel the consequence of his events in order for his events to be meaningful. If you give a man the ability to do things but not the responsibility for what he's done, there's no point. So you appoint a man prime minister and say you can do what you want for the country and you don't even have to be responsible. And just, you know, enjoy yourself. You've got all the power you want. You've got an army and a police force at your control, and you don't have to be responsible at all. The state president will be responsible for whatever goes wrong or anything. Nobody will criticize you or complain about you or anything. That's no good. That's not responsibility. And that's not authority either. It's nothing. Responsibility and authority only become meaningful, or shall we say authority only becomes meaningful. The ability to choose only becomes meaningful when you have to suffer the consequences of what you've chosen. You'll remember the example we gave of playing roulette. Playing roulette where the chips have no value. There's no excitement, there's no pleasure to playing roulette when the chips have no value. Because you can make choices, sure, you can choose whichever number you want, but it makes no difference which number you put your chip on. So it's as if you're really playing roulette with one number. That's what it really is. There's just one number, one, on the wheel, no zero, and no other numbers at all. And you can put your money on the one. That's what it means if you take the value out of the chips. If you remove the consequence, if you remove the responsibility from the action, then there's no point in the whole game. And if you tell a man, look, you've got the chira, you've got free choice, that what you do can't really have any effect. So don't worry, you don't have to take it terribly seriously. That doesn't work. And the Jewish idea of punishment is not like the Christian idea of punishment. The whole Christian idea of punishment develops from this very area in the Torah. Because the Christians, lahavdil, say that man is inconsequential. Right? He has no meaning at all, he has no authority at all, he has no power at all. If he has no power at all, does he have bechira? Does he have choice? Yes, he has choice. But that's playing roulette without the chips? Ah, but there's punishment. If you put your chip on the wrong thing, I'm going to hit you. That's it. And if you put it on the right one, I'll give you a sweet. There's no direct relationship to suffering the consequences of your action, but there's an indirect relationship. There's a God who punishes and he rewards. But that's not our idea of punishment and reward. We're not playing games, and we're not children. The Christian sees man as a child, a little kid being brought up. We don't see ourselves as children being brought up. We're adults. And as adults, that means that we're not rewarded and punished. We're given choice and responsibility. That's the difference between a child and an adult. You teach a child how to become responsibility by smacking him when he does something wrong. But the moment he grows beyond that, it doesn't help to smack him when he does something wrong. He wants the responsibility of feeling exactly what's gone wrong and developing an intuition for right and wrong by the way he's handling it. The example I always give is it's not good enough when a child plays on the table and falls off the table. Or shall we say, the child stands on the table, so you come and give the child a hiding and say, you mustn't do that, you'll fall off. How is a child meant to develop an intuitive understanding of the danger of standing on a table? All he knows is that standing on the table makes his mother angry. He doesn't know that standing on the table is dangerous. There's no way he can know it. And he won't know it until he falls off. That's the only way he's going to learn it. And that's what a child who is growing has to develop. The parent has to simply keep the children off the table until they're big enough to be able to suffer the consequences of a fall. And once the child is big enough to suffer the consequences, you let the child climb onto the table and you let the child fall. A parent has to keep a child away from matches until the child is old enough to feel the pain of fire. And then comes the time where you have to stand and watch as the child lights the match and burns his fingers. Because if he doesn't, he'll always have an artificial, inhibited relationship with the world around him, not one which is developed out of a natural understanding of the consequences of what he's doing. So the Christian religion, lahavdil, takes away consequence and says, look, human beings have consequence. You control the world. You can control God. Chas v'sholom. That would be blasphemy to Christianity. So what then is the consequences of our actions? Reward and punishment. We say no. There's no such thing as reward and punishment in that sense. There's just cause and effect. And we're given freedom of will. We can do what we want. And our responsibility is that by doing what we want, we can affect the world. Not only affect ourselves. In what way? God has established a machinery in the first 6 days. He's established a system of a machine that works. The circulation of oxygen and carbon dioxide. and the movement of the solar system, and the earth revolving around its own axis, and the change of the seasons. And he plants seeds which will continue to regenerate themselves, and the trees will regenerate themselves, and the animal world will regenerate itself. It's a perfect system which will continue to operate. Now that's like buying a motor car. And it's like buying a motor car even when the man in the showroom turns the engine on and he says, "Here, it's yours. The engine's working, you can hear it ticking over, everything's functioning perfectly. But now to make that motor car move, you've got to give petrol. You've got to put some energy into it. And then you've got to look after it later on, and if something goes wrong, you've got to correct it, and you've got to steer it, but the engine's moving. On the 6 days, during the 6 days, God created the engine, and he gave it over to man. And he said, now the speed at which it will move, the direction in which it will move, that's all in your hands. And that's what was created on Shabbos, where he built an accelerator. And he said, your foot's on it. Shabbos is to show that the machine can idle. It doesn't have to be going all the time. Up till the 6 days, God made the machine go as well. It was moving all the time. Now God stops the machine on Shabbos. It's idling. The machine doesn't stop completely. That's the principle we learned, that it's not menucha as if nothing's happening. The chiddush, the creation of Shabbos, was that without doing anything, the machine continues to operate. And he says, right, here it is. Shabbos is that moment of handing the world over from God to man. But the world is now ready, idling. God gets out and invites man to take over. And that's where Sunday starts. And that's what each Shabbos is. We spend 6 days getting the world going, and the seventh day we get out, we take a look at it, we let it idle, we listen to the way it's operating, we tune it up, ready for the next 6 days.
The word Elohim is the word which signifies, it's the name of God which signifies engineering. In a sense, precision, measurement, no room for tolerance. So have you ever met an engineer?
He's usually a very of any engineers here. No engineers. He's usually, see, an engineer doesn't come to Chumash. That's not his. It's too up in the air, Chumash. It's got to be something very clearly defined, something that he can put his finger on, something he can define, establish the limits to. No tolerance allowed. He's usually a ruthless sort of individual, ruthless with himself as well as with others, demanding things have to be just to a certain level of perfection.
That's Elohim. That's the engineering aspect of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the name with which he created the world, Bereshit Bara Elohim. God the engineer creates perfect precision. I had a meeting the other day with
I had a meeting with a German engineer. I mean, you can't imagine. He tells me with pride how he got a job done. You know, he was given a job on Friday and it was
done by Monday. I said, "That's wonderful. That's very dedicated of you to do it. You work over the weekend." He says, "Not only me." He says, "There were 100 people involved. 100 people involved. How did you get it done by Monday?" He said, "I phoned them up on the Friday, I called them back from their weekend, I phoned their wives and I phoned their children, and I told them, you will not be seeing your father, you will not be seeing your husband till Monday. I don't care. The job must be done." And I brought them back from holiday, and I brought them back. All right. That's Elohim. That's no nonsense, no tolerance, no place for human error, nothing. There's a job to be done, there's a precise way to do it, and it has to be done. Up till here, there's only Elohim. Once you introduce man, you can't have only Elohim. Now things start changing. Now you need tolerance. Now you need understanding. Now you need other things as well. But the other thing that Hashem, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, signifies is, as it's defined, in fact, you'll remember, when God says to Moshe, sends Moshe to go and speak to the people in Egypt, and Moshe says, "They'll ask me to define you. Who are you?" God says, "No. No definitions. Don't use the name Elohim. Don't let's come with engineering principles here. We're talking about people. Tell them, Eheye Asher Eheye, I shall be whom I shall be." And there are various different interpretations as to what that means. But basically what it means is, I'll be what they make me to be. That's it. According to their stature and according to their ability and according to their behavior, that's what I'll be. I can't tell you now what I'll be. It depends on how they're going to turn out as to what I'm going to be. So you have, in the concept of Hashem, the concept of responding to us. Elohim is imposing a system on us. Hashem, Yudkei Vavkei, is responding to us. That's what I meant when I said you're getting a bit Hasidic. What did I mean?
With all due respect to my very good friends, the Hasidic, it's too superficial. Hashem is Rachamim and Elohim is Din. What does it mean? Why is Elohim Din? Why is Hashem Rachamim? Elohim is not Din and Hashem is not Rachamim. Elohim is engineering and Hashem is humanity. And as a result of that, it becomes Din and Rachamim. Because once you're intolerant in terms of the Elohim, the imposition of a system onto the world, that means Din, that's law. Once you are responding to people, that's Rachamim. Those are two kinds of people, they're two aspects of godliness. One mustn't look at an engineer and say you're unhuman, and one mustn't look at a humanist and say you totally lack self-discipline, you're a flower. One has to understand that the two together make a human being, that they both have aspects of holiness. You need Elohim, you need that aspect of being able to impose upon yourself and on others, to sit and ruthlessly decide what I'm going to do next and force myself to do it. But if I want to be a living human being, I also have to be responsible. I have to be able to notice what's going on around me, respond to it, feel it, correct it. Walk into a situation and walk into a room full of people and you say something and you immediately feel you've said the wrong thing. What do you do then? Number one, you've got to be sensitive enough to notice that you've said the wrong thing. Number two, you've got to know how to correct it. You've got to be responsive enough to quickly notice and fix it. Like when you're driving. You've got to be a good engineer when you're driving. You've got to look after your car. But you've got to be responsive as well. You've got to be able to see a situation coming. If you're driving behind a bus, you've got to notice that somebody in the bus gets up and pulls the bell so that you know the bus will be stopping at the next stop. That's responding to a situation, noticing. A dog runs out into the street, you've got to be quick, you've got to swerve, you've got to correct, you've got to do something. And if you can't respond quick enough, you're going to have an accident. And if you can't look after your car like an engineer, you're also going to have an accident. You need them both. You need the precision, self-discipline, ruthlessness of the Elohim aspect of godliness, and you need the humanity of the Hashem aspect of godliness.
Now you'll understand that the two parts of the verse are not repetitious, and you'll understand why Hashem, why Shemayim and Aretz is reversed. Eile toldot Hashemayim v'haaretz behibaram. These are the generations. What does generation mean? The cause and effect. From heaven to earth, when they were created. The cause and effect of heaven relating to earth. That's Elohim. It's all been programmed up in heaven, and the earth has developed automatically. Look at Rashi. Verse 4. Says Rashi, Eile ha'amurim lamala. These things which have been said up till now, during chapter 1. Toldot ha-shamayim v'ha-aretz b'hibaram are the generations of the shamayim and the aretz when they were created b'yom asot Hashem, on the day when God made them. La-medecha, that comes to teach you. She-kulam nivru'u b'rishon, that everything was created on the first day. Right, back to the old theory of evolution, that the time was, that the creation was only on the first day. The first day was the only time that something was created ab initio. Everything else developed. By formulae that were created on the first day. By set patterns and set programs which were created on the first day. That's what it tells you. Ele toldot ha-shamayim ve'aretz behibaram. This is the generation of shamayim to aretz on the day that it was created, according to the programs at that particular time. V'yom asot Hashem Elohim. On the day, and now starts a new day. Now we're talking about the sixth day. Up till now, we've been talking about the generations of shamayim ve'aretz. Now what we're talking about is telling you the generations not only of Shamayim and Aretz as they've been up till now, but Beyom Asot Hashem Elohim. But now we're going to introduce the making of God Elohim, of Hashem Elohim, of God who responds, not only God who imposes, Eretz, the Shamayim. Now it's land where the programs are made, and that affects Shamayim. Right? So it's like you buy a computer and it comes with the programs. That's the first 6 days. But then they teach you how to make the programs yourself, and from then on you're on your own. So from the 6 days, Shamayim Va'aretz, we were given the machinery, ready programmed. From the 7th day onwards, Eretz V'Shamayim. Now it becomes the land, it becomes earth, which sets the programs and decides what will be
and Shamayim, which follows, and God follows. And that's the famous medrash that I've quoted so many times before, that the angels come to the Ribbono Shel Olam before Rosh Hashanah and they say, tell us, when's Rosh Hashanah fall this year? And God says, I don't know, go and ask the Beis Din downstairs. They'll decide whenever they decide. That's when we'll have Rosh Hashanah. What is Rosh Hashanah? Rosh Hashanah is the day that God judges us. So he sets up his Beis Din and he calls his fellow judges, so to say, and he opens the books and he discusses. And who fixes the trial, the day of the trial? We do. The litigants. We'll decide what day the trial is. Beis Din down here will decide and God will follow. And here you have the introduction of one of the first principles of Jewish philosophy. You see, now the philosophy can start. Now that man's introduced into the scene, the whole idea of Yiddishkeit starts developing. Up till now it's universal. And now we've become still universal because we're talking about man, not about Jews yet. But it's the Jewish view to man. And the first principle of the Jewish view to man is that man controls God. It's an unbelievable principle. But one begins to realize now the magnitude of your actions. That not only do your actions not have no effect, and not only do your actions affect your own lives, and not only does your actions affect the lives of your family, but your actions affect the whole world. Because what you do here has an effect up there, which in turn has an effect down here, in everything. So you can move your little finger, and something happens there. I don't know what happens when you move your little finger, but something happens. And that something that happens can change something else that happens down here again. Because that's the control room. The same as the example I gave you a long time ago about the railway yard. It was in the marriage shiurim still, maybe. It was in the marriage shiurim still. That you go into the control room and you just see a whole lot of little switches. But that's not just little switches that you play with as toys. That controls the whole railway yard outside. The trains go all day and thousands of people pass there and goods and all sorts of things. So the man is playing with his little switches in the control room, is actually controlling the lives and the destinies of many people. Where they're going to land up to. Train, he can send the train that people think they're going on holiday to Durban, and he can send them to Southwest Africa just by doing that. It's a responsibility. And likewise, when you go down to the train, if you turn a point, if you go and mechanically turn a point, a switch will be turned on his board. And that in turn will affect the whole layout on the railway line. So there's an reciprocity, what we started off by saying. God throws something at us, watches how we respond, and our response will determine what he throws at us next. And not just at us as individuals, but as us as the world. So it emerges that every little thing we say, every little action we do, every thought we have, has an effect in God's world, which is the control board, which automatically has an effect back there. Because you're changing the quality of that control board. It's not just a little quantitative thing, an extra little movement of a finger. Because actions are quantitative. Every action has a heart behind it. And the quality of that heart behind an action affects the quality of God's control system, which in turn affects the quality of everything done here. The difference between quantity and quality is that quantity, if I have 10 books and I add on an 11th book, that the 11th book doesn't affect the 10. There's just one more. But the 10 remain the same. Whereas quality is like wisdom. If I know 100 pieces of Gemara and I learn 101 pieces of Gemara, that extra piece of Gemara is a quantitative addition, because that now affects my understanding of all the other 100. So when I move my little finger, since there's a heart behind that movement of a finger, every movement that a human being makes has a heart behind it. Since there's a heart behind it, there's quality. And that quality means that it's not just another movement up there. It's not just a quantitative addition to God's control board. It's a qualitative addition. Everything changes. The change might be minute, but sometimes even a minute change is important. And when you're controlling aeroplanes at Frankfurt Airport or one of these busy places, you might say, what's 6 inches here or there? What's half a minute here or there? Half a minute can be the difference between life and death for hundreds and hundreds of people. And when one's talking about what we're talking about, the tiniest little things can be important,
not only for oneself but for others as well. One begins to understand the magnitude of life, the importance of life, of what it is. It's not just important. My life is not just important to me. My life is important to the world. And that's why I can't say to the world, mind your own business, what I do is my business. There's no such thing. Nothing that I do is my business. I mean only my business. Everything I do is the world's business too. Doesn't mean the world has a right to talk about it, and certainly not to talk badly about it. But to have an interest in it, yes. And likewise, I'd better have an interest in everything that the world is doing.
And if I see somebody doing wrong, I can't just walk off and say that's his problem. That's how he wants to live, let him live that way. It's like sitting in a ship and watching a man at the side of the ship hammer away at the ship. He wants to hammer away at the ship, that's his business. We're all going to go down. Anybody would stop a man doing that. Imagine sitting in an aeroplane. The fellow hammering away on the side of the aeroplane quietly. And the fellow next to him saying, oh, it's your business, you want to hammer away, that's fine. Or the fellow with a grenade and he's about to take the pin out. You want to When we view it from a Torah point of view, the world is a ship. We're all in it together. And anybody who wants to damage the ship has got to account not only to God, but to us as well.
It sounds on the one hand frightening and depressing, but on the other hand it's extremely exciting. Because one understands the consequence and the worth of what one's doing.
And imagine yourself if I came and I told you, look, we're terribly sorry, Mr. So-and-so, to do this to you, but we've considered the situation in America and we find that none of the candidates are very happy prospects. We've decided we would like you to come and take over. You walk into the office, what do? Get depressed at the weight of the decisions that lie in front of you, or excited by the opportunities? A mixture of both, it's mixed feelings. That's the kind of feeling when you understand what life is all about.
You should walk out of the Beis HaMidrash understanding that if you think the President of America has power, you don't know what power is. You've got the power. And the degree of the power is simply not understood because of primitive understanding. If I would take my little baby to the airport and show her a jumbo jet and say, look, one man can take this jumbo jet into the sky,
she'll laugh. How can you take two big things as one man? You need thousands of people to lift it into the sky. But it's not like that. One man can sit down, and if he knows how to do it, he can go. Off you can go. We look and we say, one person can change the world? I have within me the power to change the world? Don't be silly. Me? Who am I? If you know the key, you can change the world. That's all. Sure, the world's big. Sure, it's difficult to change. But if you know how to do it, it can be done. A man who knows how to fly a jumbo jet can fly it. And it doesn't help just sitting there and saying, this can't be moved. One man can't do it. One man has to learn how to do it, and he can do it.
And so it is with one's relationship to the world. Eretz v'shamayim. Eretz becomes the cockpit now. Before, Shamayim used to be the cockpit. Now the cockpit's here. God puts us at the controls. And he gives us a Torah, which is the training book. And he says, you can take over now. Let's just go a little bit further. B'chol tziach ha-sadeh terem yiyeh va'aretz, b'chol esiv ha-sadeh terem yitzmach. And this was at the point where all the plants of the field did not really exist in the land, and all the grass of the field was not yet growing. Ki lo himtir Hashem Elokim al ha'aretz, because God didn't bring rain onto the land. Right? The Adam ayin la'avod et ha'adamah, and there was no man to work the land. The eid ya'aleim in ha'aretz, and a mist used to come up from the land. The hishka et kol pnei ha'adamah, and it watered the whole land.
Oh, that's crazy with respect to the Torah. Things weren't growing because there was no rain, because and there was no man, but a mist used to come and water everything.
Was there water or wasn't there water? The mist used to come and water. Who needs the rain? Why wasn't everything growing? So let's read it carefully. And every growing thing was not yet growing in the land, and the grass on the field was not yet growing, because God did not bring rain. There are two words in the Torah that we use for rain.
Geshem and Matar. Geshem is water that comes down, and Geshem is not necessarily beneficial for crops. Right? When the Torah uses the word Geshem, the Malbim says that's not necessarily a word that indicates something beneficial to crops.
Floods are also called Geshem. Heavy rain at the wrong time, the wrong season, rain which can destroy crops, that's also called Geshem. Matar is the correct kind of rain. Matar is rain which is suited to the particular needs of the crops. Geshem, says the Malbim, was built into the program. The fact that rain would come down, the cycle of water from earth to subterranean to evaporation to condensation back to rain, the whole story, that was built into the 6-day program. But matar was not. Right? Water would come down, But 9 out of 10 times that water would destroy the crops. It wouldn't keep the crops going. Matar is a result of human effort. Rain. That's why Eretz Israel has no rivers. Because they've got to know that their crops, that their economy is dependent on human behavior. Okay? And Israel's economy is not in a very happy state. Okay? Which says something for Israel's behavior. And one trip to Israel shows you what. All the other countries are managing somehow or other because they behave like men should. Not like moral men should, maybe. Not like moral human beings. Not like great human beings. But in other countries, people generally behave like human beings. In Israel, they don't behave like human beings. And their problems, economic problems, we're told in the Torah. The economic cycle of Israel, directly connected to the standard of behavior of the people. They don't have to be particularly great for the economy to go wonderfully. They just have to be normal human beings. They just have to be considerate to one another. That's the one thing which they've never been in modern Israel. And that's what we say in the Shema, in the second paragraph. V'haya in shamoa tishmu el mitzvotayin. It will be if you listen to my mitzvot. Then I will give you as a result of your relationship to me matar. Geshem will come automatically, but geshem is not necessarily a blessing. Matar is always a blessing. So what the Torah tells us here is there was no matar, right? Why? Because there was no man to serve the land, to work on the land. If there's no man, there's no matar. Matar is connected to human behavior. Therefore, the aid yalem in haaretz v'hishkat kol pnei adamah, this mist used to come in and used to indiscriminately water everywhere. But that's not good for the crops to indiscriminately water. The beauty of rain is where it comes, what areas it comes, at what seasons it comes. But just every night for a mist to come and water everything, that's not going to do the crops any good. Therefore, v'yitzer Hashem Elokim et Adam, God made man. And the important thing to see here is that the world could not have continued to operate without man. It wasn't a complete cycle. What was missing? Man was missing. Why was man missing? Because you need matar. Geshem isn't sufficient. The formula that was built in, the program that was built in, was okay on the surface, but it couldn't have lasted because there would never have been matar until Vayitzer Hashem Elokim et Ha'adam. And again, Hashem Elokim, God makes man. It's Hashem and it's Elokim. In man he infuses both Elohim, the imposition of a system, and Hashem responsiveness to a situation. Afar min ha'adama, he makes him from the dust of the ground. So we're made from the low of the low. But vayipach bi'afav nishmat chayim, he breathes into them a breath of life. And the Gemara says, man denafach, when a person breathes, he breathes from right inside himself. So where does this breath of life come from? Right from inside God. The very essence of godliness he puts into us. And that's what man is. Here we have a definition of man. This is not telling us about the creation of man, because we've already learnt about the creation of man. This is telling us what man is. What is a man? This is the definition of a man. A man is dust of the earth with a vayipach bi'afav, with an element of godliness inside him. He has all the elements of the basest of earthy animals. And at the same time, he has an element of God himself inside. And it's the relationship between these two which constitutes man. It's not godliness on its own, and it's not earthiness on its own. You can't be a hedonist, and you can't be an angel. Being a man is watching that relationship between godliness and physicality. There's a film showing in town at the moment called The Runner Stumbles. Has anybody seen it? You should see it for many reasons. One reason I'll probably talk about some other time. But one of the things that comes out there is this is a conflict which a priest of the Catholic Church goes through in basically falling in love with one of his young nuns. It's one of these absolutely clean pictures where depths of intimacy in a relationship between a man and woman are disclosed on the screen without the man and woman even touching each other, and certainly without any of them getting undressed. with far more intimacy and delicacy. Unfortunately, not a lot of money was spent on the film.
That's like one of these films.
It could have been a Man for All Seasons kind of stature of a film. It's not that. It's a cheap little film. But they have successfully done several things. That's the one thing which I've just told you. And the second thing is to see the torment of a man who has to live in a religion that believes that God is perfect, man is imperfect, therefore for a man to be perfect, he can't be human. And that's really what Catholic doctrine is. God is perfect, man is imperfect, man is obliged to be godly, but to be godly, you can't be human. And it's that conflict he lives in. It's the feeling that there's afarmina adama, that man is either made from dust on the earth or vayipach biyapach. But that's not Yiddishkeit. Yiddishkeit is we're both. And the art is to find the kedusha in both. To run away from being a human being and try and be holy, that's not kedusha. To indulge in materialism and forget about being holy, that's not humanity. In the Motzei Shabbos here 2 weeks ago, we discussed that God makes sweetness, he makes a bitter thing sweet with another bitter thing. Bitter plus bitter equals sweet. What does that mean? Kedusha, the ethereal nature of kedusha, its restrictiveness, when you look at it on its own, inhuman. And that's what one sees in this film. The torment of a very human man battling with the inhumanity of kedusha. Because kedusha, if one looks at it coldly and abstractly, is unhuman. And if one looks at life without kedusha, it's also unhuman. Because it's lower than animal. So where does one find it? Put those two bitter things together. The apparent bitterness of kedusha with the apparent bitterness of life. And you have a holy life. You have a life of kedusha, and that's sweet. That's beautiful. And that's where kedusha lies. Vayipach be'apav nishmas chayim. He breathed into that materialism. He breathed holiness. And so one can cry when one reads it. One has an instruction here from the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Torah told us, look what you are, man. Look why I made you. I made you as someone into whom, someone terribly physical, into whom I could breathe kedusha. That's what I want out of you. I don't need more gods. There's one God. That's enough. I don't need more angels. I don't need more animals. What I need is somebody who's a link with both these worlds. What I need is the person who can affect, who can be the cockpit. He's sufficiently close to the material world to be able to respond to it, and he's sufficiently close to the spiritual world to be able to control it, and to be able to relate to it. And the only way you can do that is by having both of these together in one. So what I want is for you to retain your physicality, but to instill into that kedusha. I want you to be businessmen, I want you to be professional men, I want you to eat, I want you to sleep, I want you to get married, I want you to have children, I want you to till the land, I want you to live as normal human beings. But with vayipach be'atav, breathe into what you're doing, nishmas chayim, the breath of life. And we have an instruction of what it is to be a human being. Not to run away from life, not to run away from situations, to try and be holy. One won't find kedusha somewhere far. One finds kedusha right in one's everyday activities. Vayehi ha'odom le'nefesh chayim. And man became a living soul. Why did it use this term for the first time with man and not with the animals? Animals also became living souls. Look at Rashi. It's right at the end of this, verse 7, Pasuk Zayin. Just before verse 8. L'nefesh chaya. Have you got it? Af behema v'chaya nikru nefesh chaya. Even the animals and the cattle and the wild animals were also called nefesh chaya. So why does it refer to it specifically here? Achzu shel adam chaya shebekulam. But this one of man is the most living of all. Man is more alive than anyone else. I'll stop there for a moment. Don't look any further. Why is man more alive than anyone else? Living is the opposite. You normally, when one wants to look at life, you look at a butterfly, the freedom of the butterfly. That's life. Look at the birds and all. What are the poets? When the poets write about life, do they write about people or about birds and bees? Sorry? That's what David says, but control is the opposite of this nefesh chaya.
What we're talking about is life, alive, being alive.
Really? But that's not life. That's not a bad point. That's not a bad point. Look at Rashi. Shini Tosef Bo, because he's given in addition to other aspects of life, two things. And here you have defined what a human being is. Right? We've actually had him defined before, is the relationship between man and between dust on the one hand and Vayipat Be'apav on the other hand. But in terms of what makes you human, how do you retain that humanity? Two things. Deo, knowledge, v'dibur, communication. Those are the two things that distinguish a man from an animal. Deo, v'dibur.
Deo, knowledge. I don't even like translating deo as knowledge. I would rather translate deo as wisdom. There's a difference between the two.
If you think about it carefully, what would you rather have? Think about it really carefully. If you think what you've learned tonight, unfortunately what happens with shiurim like this is people tend to regard it as an evening's entertainment
and a little bit of intellectual stimulation and feels good and sounds interesting, and you didn't know that there was quite so much depth into the chumash, and off you go and you live the same way as you lived before. But if you stop for a moment and think
what you know out of learning these couple of psukim, what worlds are open to you now? What power is open to you now? Knowing that, if I said to you when you were 17 years old, you can go to university and get yourself a PhD in any subject you want, or I'll teach you these three psukim, which would you prefer?
What should a man say? What choice is there? So you'll go and you'll get a PhD. What's it going to teach you?
It's going to teach you a narrow area of information. It's going to give you a certain technical ability, and that's about it. But these three psukim can change a man's life forever. Every moment of your life can be changed if you simply operate on the basis of the understanding of these three psukim. And it's just, it's purely coincidental we happen to take on these three psukim. I could give the same shiur that I'm talking about now on any three psukim of the Torah. It's any posuk of the Torah, any piece of Gemara, of Chumash, and I understand what it's all about really. Is one going to be prepared to swap that for anything in the whole world? That's Chochmah, that's Deah. Because this now changes status. No PhD changes your status. Changes your status in the eyes of society, maybe, but not in your own eyes. If you're going to be honest with yourself, are you different when you got a PhD to before you got a PhD?
One minute you're one man, and when Harry Oppenheimer shakes your hand, you're another man? Changed? Different? New responsibilities? New understandings? What's happened? There's been no change.
But if one would take this knowledge that we've got tonight, and you would internalize it, and you would work out how to use it, how to operate with it, how to apply it, you're a man of different stature, or a lady of different stature. You're simply not the same person that you were before you walked in this evening. Not with the same abilities, not with the same power, not with the same understanding. That's Deya, that's Chochmah. To actually change oneself from one human being into another human being, simply by understanding something that you didn't understand before, one cannot overestimate the power of such knowledge of what it is. And that's what distinguishes a man from an animal.
Yeah, one can say the Torah is just a religion of ritual. It's one kind of Yiddishkeit. And one can say that another kind of Yiddishkeit is just get into the atmosphere, man, and you know, sing and dance and have a good time. And that's another kind of Yiddishkeit. But none of that can change your stature. None of that can make you from one human being into another human being. There's only one thing that can change stature. That's Deo. To learn a piece of Torah that you didn't know before. And Torah is not only learnt in the Chumash. Torah is learnt outside. Torah is learnt every time you speak to somebody. Torah is learnt every time you notice somebody. Torah is learnt every time you look at a tree or a flower or at the sky or at anything. Torah is learnt every time you read the newspaper. Torah is learnt when you read Shakespeare, whatever it is. If one can take something and understand the essence of it and apply it correctly and see, be able to know what to reject and what to accept, that if one can find a principle of Torah, the difference is in Torah you get it in every pasuk. You can open the Chumash anywhere and you'll learn one pasuk properly and you'll have Torah. Sometimes in Shakespeare, one has Shakespeare's the best, even in Shakespeare, one has to sometimes read many, many, many pages to get one principle, get one little idea, which sometimes is even wrong. That's the difference. But it can be done, even then. In the newspaper, the same applies. But what I'm saying is that one's learning process doesn't stop when you walk out of a Beit HaMikdash. One's learning process goes on all the time. But to understand, to know one piece of Torah, that changes. There's nothing else. There's no shortcut to Yiddishkeit. In terms of that, one doesn't have to say, look, I've got to understand the whole thing before I'm a Jew. That's not the way it works. Just understand one pasuk today and another pasuk tomorrow, and if you can put into practice what you learn today and you put into practice what you learn tomorrow, do you know how much greater you'll be than you were 2 days before? And if the third day you learn another pasuk and the fourth day another pasuk, you'll be a great man in a week's time, and in 2 weeks' time, and in 6 months' time, and in a year's time. As long as the learning process goes on a little bit, each day a little bit more, there's got to be a little bit more each day. There's got to be progress. You've got to go to bed knowing that you've understood something today that you didn't understand yesterday. Otherwise, there's no growth. You might have had a good time today. You might have seen a good movie today. You might have made a lot of money today. But if you didn't understand something today that you didn't understand yesterday, then you've wasted a day. Then there's been no growth in stature. It can be a tiny thing, but there's a new understanding, a new life. And this is qualitative. This changes everything you do. That's qualitative knowledge, and one has to be very, very careful not to never speak enough about this, not to allow Torah to become quantitative knowledge. You don't go to bed saying, what do you know today? I know another chapter. I know another page. I know another Masechta. That's it. That doesn't give you any satisfaction. When you ask yourself as you're lying down and you're going to bed, before you say Kriya Shema, what do I know today that I didn't know yesterday? It's got to be a principle. It's got to be a concept that you can apply today that you couldn't apply yesterday. And you've got to know how you're going to apply it. And that's when one's revising. It's not just good enough revising the words. One has to revise the concepts and understand them properly. That's Dayan. That's the only way in Yiddishkeit. There is no other way in Yiddishkeit. Yeah, for pedestrians there are other ways, but not for people who want to change stature. If you feel that you're a great person already, if you feel you've reached the top and you can't go any higher, then there are other ways in Yiddishkeit, then you can relax a little bit. But if you plan still to get a little bit higher, this is the way to do it. Dayan. And one other. Dibur. Dibur is communication. Expression. In fact, if you look at Unkelus, those of you who've got Unkelus on the side, you'll see he actually translates Lenefesh Chaya, the last words in verse 7, Meruach Memalala, a spirit of communication. Memalala from the word Mila, the ability to talk. And that's the other area where the human being differs from the animal. That's the ability not only to know something you didn't know yesterday, but to be able to express it. Because knowledge which you've acquired, which can't be expressed, is knowledge which doesn't take part in the dynamics of living with it. Knowledge becomes dynamic when you've absorbed it and you're able to express it again. You're able to express it in action, and you're able to express it in words. You're able to transmit it to others. And then the world becomes an exciting place to live in. Imagine if everybody's in different shiurim tonight. Everybody in Johannesburg is at a shiur. One's learning Chumash, and one's learning Tanakh, and one's learning Halachas, and one's learning Gemara. Everybody's learning. And at 9:25, everybody goes out into the street. And imagine that there's the excitement with what they've learned, there's this new understanding. Imagine the noise you're going to get in the street. Exchanging ideas, what they heard. That's a yeshiva. That's what a yeshiva is. Everybody goes into their shiurim and they learn something and they come out into the Beis HaMedrash, and there's this tremendous tumult going on, this tremendous noise that you hear from the Beis HaMedrash. People exchanging ideas. This is how I understand it. This is how I understand it. Could it be this way? Could it be that way? Developing a new understanding or a deeper understanding. That's communication, because through communication the ideas are exchanged and in fact improved more than they could have been before. And that's Odom, that's the man we're introducing to the Chumash at this point. Now it's a little Adam that impotent and unable to do anything for himself, that sat under a fig tree and did wrong. That's not the Odom. We've introduced him. Odom, who's a man with Deo, a man with Chochma, a man with Dibur, with communication, a man who's going to control the destiny of the world, and we're going to see the meaning of actions and the power of action, and to what extent his choice is able to affect not only himself, but the whole of society and the whole of humanity. That's the way it's going to develop, and that's the way it's going to unfold. But it's important that in Adam we see ourselves. Because Adam is created, and that's why he was created only as one. So we can't, when we're learning this, we can't say to ourselves, it's Adam, but I'm descended from somebody else. That's not how I work. This is how we all work. This is Adam. This is the prototype. We're studying man. We're not studying Adam. Adam in Hebrew means Adam, and it also means man. We're studying man. We're studying mankind. What is a human being? That's what we're learning in the Chumash Aleihem. And when we analyze Adam and we see him operate, we're seeing man with a capital M operating. Not one particular man, one individual man. But that we'll do in the Tashem in 2 weeks' time.